Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
I think people that have experience from different industries and they can bring those into dentistry quite often have a slightly different flavour to them, don't they?
Yeah, I think they have a different view, don't they? They're sort of like they've followed a different path. And it's funny, isn't it? Business is business is business. Mm. But yet again, talking to Jonathan, it's about people, it's about relationships, and it's about how you create those. And what he does creates them when people think they've lost. It's quite an interesting one, really.
And also, he's harnessing of a business tool that lots of people overlook because they kind of head down that digital path, and he's using a tool that's been around since Alexander Graham Bell designed it, but he's bringing it back and for practices' benefits. I think people are probably going to pause and just think about how they engage with their patients as a result of this episode.
Old still works.
Exactly. I think people are going to really enjoy this one.
Yeah, brilliant. Good.
You know what it is?
It's a podcast.
It is.
Oh, I love them. Absolutely love them.
Same here. Well, today, we've got someone we've known for many, many years.
I was thinking about that. It is quite a while, actually. It was, I don't know, 5, 10 years?
I go nearer 10 than 5, yeah.
I suppose so, 5 is just before COVID, really, exactly, almost, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. So it's got to be longer than that.
So today, we are very fortunate. We have Jonathan Webster joining us, and Jonathan is the Managing Director of World of Mouth Marketing.
It's clever, that clever world. Name. Very world, clever name.
Very
word,
clever name. So World of Mouth Marketing, and it's a telemarketing business working solely with UK dental practices and dental groups.
And fascinating.
Exactly. Welcome, Jonathan. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Andy.
How long do you think we have known one another for? We were musing between 5 and 10. You were chipping with 10.
Actually. So I can remember about 10 years ago coming to see you guys. I think I'd been in London and, you know, I just kind of swung by your place and we went down to that pub at the end of the road that you used to use as a boardroom.
We still do.
We still do, yeah.
Right, great. And we had a coffee and all that kind of stuff. And when I left you, I was heading back around the M25 to pick up the A1 to come back up north. And I pulled in at South Mimms, which isn't a million miles away from you, I don't think, is it?
No, just around the corner.
No.
And as I was pulling into the car park, the phone rang. So I was kind of picked up the phone. I was chatting, you know, and I got out of the car as I was chatting to someone, and there was an empty water bottle on the seat. So I grabbed that. I thought I'd throw that in the bin on the way over to the services. I was going to buy a coffee. So walking across the car park, finished my call, walked past these bins, chucked the bottle in, went into the services, and I looked in my hand, and I still had the bottle, but I'd thrown my bloody phone away.
Excellent.
So that's my lasting memory of you guys.
Great. Oh, I'm pleased that we got a memory, yeah.
After coming to see you. And, I had to go back to the bin. I mean, I was suited and booted and all that.
You're rummaging.
But there wasn't just one bin. There were 3 in a row, and I didn't know which one I'd thrown it in. So I had to go through all 3 to find this phone. Obviously, the phone was kaput, but I managed to retrieve the SIM card.
Nice.
So that was 10 years ago. And I bet it's 10 years ago almost to the day.
Wow,
just on the water bottle thing, and it's before we start, it's a real segue, but I read an article recently about people throwing water bottles away that still have water in them, and apparently we're losing hundreds of millions of gallons of water, which are now they're now contained in water bottles, because obviously they stay in the water bottle, takes that bottle, you know, forever to break down, and that water is effectively lost from the planet.
Interesting. Wow.
So the point being is for anyone listening to this, we should all make sure we completely empty our water bottle by drinking or on plants or wherever, so that it stays available to us, because once it's in that bottle and once it goes in landfill, it's gone. Yeah, pretty much gone.
I think I might be able to top the random throwing away shit. So when my kids were small, I can remember we took a you know, they go up and down the Thames on those funny old boat things. And there's a girl called Poppy. I won't shame her because I don't know her surname. And she took all these pictures with one of those disposable cameras and then threw it in the bin. Well, I said to her, what are you doing? She went, it's a disposable camera. I said, but don't you want the pictures? She went, oh, yeah.
We should start. I'm sure people didn't join in for these random stories. So, yeah. Jonathan, to kick us off, before we get to your dental career, take us back to your childhood. Where did you grow up? What
many
was
years
life
ago.
Like back then?
Many years ago, yeah.
God. Wow. Well, I'm the youngest of six kids.
Six kids,
four sisters and a brother. Wow, there's brilliant. A 14-year age gap between me and my eldest sister, Janet. My parents divorced when I was about six. But despite that, you know, I had a really, really happy childhood. And it was quite a privileged childhood as well, to be fair. You know, at the time, my dad was kind of riding high in business. But then when I got to about 10 years old, all that money seemed to have disappeared, and we never really got to the bottom of how it went or where it went or anything. disappear it did. My life kind of changed quite a bit. You know, I came out of public school into the comprehensive system, which was great. You know, it was absolutely brilliant. I've got friends that I'm still friends with today. You know, I go out boozing and all sorts of stuff.
Are you a northerner born and bred?
No, Leeds lad, yeah.
Ah, Leeds, yeah.
Man and boy. But I didn't do very well at comprehensive school. So my mum said, right, you're going to have to go to boarding school. Otherwise, you're not going to get any O-levels. So she kind of scrimped and saved and sent me off to boarding school. I was there about 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
It was fantastic. Absolutely loved it. I had an absolute ball of a time. You know, you're with your mates all day and weekends. There's always stuff to do. You know, you've got access to a swimming pool and, you know, a gym and a cricket pitch and tennis courts and all that. You know, there's never a dull moment.
That must have been a big cost to her with five other kids.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
One thing I've gone through boarding schools, so that was kind of
dead. Oh wow,
that's very impressive.
Flip.
Very impressive.
So yeah, I was very fortunate. You know, I really thank her for that.
I think it's incredible when you hear stories of what parents. What parents are prepared to do for their kids. Quite often, we speak to lots of dentists that perhaps might have joined us from overseas, you know, India or different countries. And quite often the sacrifices that their parents have made coming to the UK to give kind of a better life for their kids. And that's kind of a story that's been told time and again. But I don't think we'd heard a story like yours, which is where obviously father was doing well, kind of an entrepreneur's life means that sometimes things don't always go so well. Change for you, but then your mum kind of pulled it back and made sure that somehow you kind of got that education that you wanted.
Can you imagine when I'm just thinking, if there's 14 years and all the other guys have gone through boarding school, obviously depending on the financial situation, that your mum, when you finally finished, she must be like, woohoo,
relief.
She was. I'll tell you a funny story about that, actually. So, from school, I had literally no idea what I wanted to do. You know, my mum, as is probably quite apparent, she had high aspirations for me. And she wanted me to go to Sandhurst Military Academy. Following the footsteps of my cousin, who at the time was the youngest major in the British Army.
Wow.
So she was like, you know, you've got to go and do that. So I completely ignored that advice and went to catering college to study hotel management.
Brilliant. Did she not? Did she sort of forgive you and say that's okay?
I don't think she ever forgave me for that, to be honest.
Oh, really?
No. So you opted for, So you opted for the hot cross buns over the crosshairs.
Exactly. That's
very
it,
good. Yeah. I thought, see what you did there. That was clever. That was clever. Yeah, yeah.
But funnily enough, when I was at catering college, we got sent out into industry. So I ended up working in a hotel, quite a big hotel on the Isle of Wight, when I was 17. And
I was there for the summer season. Somewhat different than Leeds.
And when I came back from that, just coming back to my mum, she'd moved house and not told me. So I think that's how disappointed she was.
Excellent. Did she leave a forwarding address?
Yeah, she sent it to Sandhurst.
Oh, brilliant. That is great.
She'd only moved around the corner, so it was fine.
Oh, so wow. When did you find out? When you like knocked on the door where you used to live? Or did you find out
back into
before
Leeds.
You did?
I got back into Leeds and, phoned her. Obviously, we didn't have mobile phones back then. I was in a phone box. Fortunately, she'd taken the number with her, so the telephone number still worked. And I said, I'm in Leeds. So I said, I'll be around. I'll be back in 20 minutes or whatever. And
lucky you rang, though.
She said, I've moved. I've moved just around the corner to such and such an address. And there you go. Wow.
One of my friends' mum and dad did that. She went on holiday and she didn't see them for a bit. And she came back again and actually went up to the front door, knocked on the front door, and these people opened there. And she said, who are you? And they said, well, we own the house now. And she said, she'd been away for like 3 months or something, and then told her. So then she had to go and find like one of her aunties and find out where her mum and dad lived. Jeez. How bizarre is that?
Yeah.
Imagine if you hadn't rung, though. Yeah. That'd be great. You rock up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hello.
Exactly.
So perhaps much to your mum's... So perhaps much to your mum's disappointment, you were in the hotel and restaurant industry. What did those industries teach you that proved to be kind of useful? What things have you taken forward with you from those worlds?
So I think the first is a great work ethic. You've got to work hard in the kind of hotel and restaurant business because you're up against a deadline all the time because you've got, guests arriving at a hotel, people coming in to eat in restaurants and so on. So there's always a deadline. You've got to get your arse in gear, basically. But then there's that whole thing about teamwork. I know it sounds a bit cliched, but you really do operate as a team, particularly if you're in a kitchen environment, a busy kitchen environment. I mean, I've worked in restaurants where we're knocking out 500 meals, a la carte meals a night. There's kind of 10 or 12 chefs in there, but you've all got to be talking to each other all the time and that communication and backing each other up and checking everyone's all right. And it's absolutely vital.
Find it amazing to get that consistency. Consistency with all that.
Yeah, the same skills transfer, into any industry. It's really, really important. The great thing about particularly working in restaurants in a kitchen environment is the adrenaline rush, actually, because, you spend 2 or 3 hours preparing everything for service, and then all of a sudden you're hit with, 20, 30 checks coming in and you're cooking for, 100, 150 people within 15 minutes of opening. And it's just bang. The rush is just tremendous. And it never leaves you, actually. I was out with one of my friends that I used to work with in catering probably about a month ago. And we were just talking about it, the good old days kind of thing. We both agreed, it never ever leaves you.
I'm intrigued only because I think hospitality has quite a lot of crossover with dentistry.
Yeah.
I think lots of dental practices, particularly now where you see nice private practices offering kind of borderline concierge services. Yeah. So I'm always intrigued at what we kind of can learn from hospitality, hotel and restaurants and how that relates into a dental practice. Because whilst it arguably isn't as kind of high pressure in that kind of, you know, short period of time. I think how you deliver that service is similar. So I was just interested in what those transferable skills were that you learnt back then that have served you well. Yeah, I think dental practices can learn lots in those markets.
There's no question about it. It's that becoming more customer focused, I suppose. Whenever I visited the dentist, in my younger days, it's always been an NHS dentist. And, you're on a bit of a conveyor belt, really. You're in and out and off you go kind of thing. And private dentists, I would say when I first stepped into dentistry, it was still a little bit like that. But I've certainly seen over the years that they are becoming more customer focused because they're recognising that, to a certain extent, the retail businesses, and they've got to look after the punters. It's as simple as that. They're not just patients who they're doing a favour for. You know, the patients that are coming in and they're doing a favour for the dentist, really, by giving them the business.
How did you get into it then? Because obviously you did a bit of catering, and then did you work in catering after catering college? And then how did you end up getting into dentistry?
Up until the age of about 25, I would say. As I said earlier, I never had a plan about what I wanted to do. I just kind of did things that I enjoyed. So what I did after I left catering, just for a year, I went off driving HGVs, childhood dream to drive a big truck.
Really?
Yeah. So So I passed my HGV test and I knew it was never going to be a lifelong thing. You know, it was just something I wanted to do. So I went off driving 30-ton.
Did you do continent or UK?
No,
or?
It was all local stuff. It was driving 30-ton tipper trucks. You know, kind of running stone out of quarries and stuff like that. And I did that for 12 months just to get that out of my system. And then I thought, right, I've got to get a proper job here. So I ended up.
I'll be an astronaut.
Yeah,
I've done the tipper truck. I'll be an astronaut now.
I'm now going to join Eddie Stober and do a big one across the continent.
So I ended up working for someone you guys know, Johnny Fine. Had his advertising business, I kind of went to work in there, and they just established.
Was that your first introduction to dentistry?
Introduction to marketing.
Was that when he was doing Bentley and all that sort of stuff? Would that have been?
Yes. So when I started, they just set up a telemarketing operation. It was a new thing for that business. We were working for IBM in the main at the time, lead generation for their kind of SME business teams.
So what year's about this then, Jonathan? This is that about sort of late 90s or so?
Early 90s. Kind of 91, something like that. But that business started to grow a little bit, and you know, I ended up basically running the whole telemarketing operation. I'd have to say probably 80 people in there, 90 people. It was mainly business to business work. We were doing appointment setting and lead generation for people like O2. You mentioned Bentley, Chris. Yeah, we did a lot for Bentley. That was great work.
And Jonathan, what did it look like back then? Because obviously now when we talk about direct marketing, digital marketing, a lot of it is done through kind of platforms. Facebook ads, Google ads, was this telephone based, literally ringing people up and physically booking them in a diary?
Yeah, so it was all offline stuff. After about, probably about 3 years in, once it got quite serious, we bought some PCs.
Look at that, playing with the big boys.
Yeah, seriously. So it was all paper-based. You know, you got all these people generating paper, filling out questionnaires and things like that.
The irony that you're working for IBM.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And, absolutely wow. Right. You know, we'd send all the leads off in the post every night to the
Flair.
Yeah. And wow. You know, if we were running late, we had to drive down to the Royal Mail office in Leeds. Yeah, it's from the office. It's kind of there and back. It's about an hour and a half. It was
Jonathan. Thinking back to these you know, global businesses. In terms of the brand and the business they have, what do they do differently in terms of their market positioning? Obviously, we all work with small businesses, you know, dental practices, and you know, they're fabulous in their own right, but then they're not kind of at that level. So what do those businesses do differently that smaller businesses can learn from in terms of how they position themselves and brand themselves?
Yeah, I think the thing is with those businesses, they've got a structure in place. you know, so they've got a good lead generation and a kind of function going on, and they've got the sales teams to follow that up, you know, whether it's business to business or business to consumer. So that's the main thing they're doing differently to a smaller business, I would say. Mm. Right. In terms of branding, I've got to say I'm not a brand expert at all. I'm not very good at it. You know, I'll hold my hands up and say that. You know, they've just got big budgets that they can throw out there and get awareness going and things like that. And they've got people to do it. They've got resource. You know, when you're an SME, you know, like us, we're a little business. You're kind of doing it all yourself. It's a bit like dental practices with the practice manager wearing so many hats. Just to try and keep that business going.
And process, I think you say process is the most important thing. So
yeah,
you can keep repeating, can't you?
Systemizing.
Otherwise it just becomes random and then it either gets forgotten or there's errors or whatever. And process is such a key thing.
Has it become easier, Jonathan, with the advent of, you know, digital marketing and social media, using technology? Does it mean that it's easier today for small businesses to compete with the bigger brands? Whereas before, if it was just employing people, getting them on the phones, there's a human cost there. But are people able to better use technology today to get more exposure that perhaps they couldn't have in years gone by?
Yeah, I think so. But it's probably so crowded now in just about every marketplace, isn't it? It's so everyone's shouting, you know, on social media and whatever. But, you know, the question is there any cut through to get people listening? That's the difficulty, I would say.
And the good old phone, isn't it? The good old phone still works. Well, we struggle, and I don't, but, you know, we're trying to get, when we have new people, especially younger people, is getting them to actually answer the phone. They're like, I don't know what they're going to say. Well, that's the idea of a phone, because you have to answer it, otherwise you don't find out.
That's
what
the fun
say.
Of it.
But it is amazing, isn't it? We were saying that I think the last few guys, because they're young, they'd be the late teens or early 20s, they're not really used to using a phone to make phone calls.
That's right.
Or receive phone calls. It's quite fascinating.
Right. It's all messaging now, isn't it? But I think also with the advent of social media, they're all kind of self-serve platforms, aren't they? So, you know, a lot of people, they get involved in it. They'll go onto a social media platform and they can set up their account, they can set up their advertising account, and they can, you know, they can filter out a target market. But they still don't really know what they're doing, I don't think. And so I think they chuck quite a bit of money at it, but it doesn't always work for them. And it can leave a bit of a sour taste in the mouth. But for me personally, I mean, I'm a great fan of the phone, because I think somewhere along the line, even if you're using social media to generate your initial inquiry, there's got to be a conversation somewhere.
And I think people connect with people. Don't know. I think we've got AI. There's lots of tech out there that helps us. But I think it's very hard to find something that genuinely replaces having a conversation with another human being. In fact, that leads on nicely. Could you perhaps explain to us what word of mouth marketing actually does for dental practices? Because we've been talking around the phone. Yeah, it'd be good just for everybody to find out what it is that you do.
Yeah. Okay, so we're really unique in dentistry. There's lots and lots of dental marketing agencies out there, but I think they all tend to focus on social media, SEO, PPC campaigns, and so on. We don't get involved in any of that. We're kind of at the rough end of marketing, really, where we offer telephone-based marketing solutions. So everything we do involves the telephone. It involves making a telephone call, and it's always a call that's best handled away from the front desk in a dental practice. So what tends to happen in our experience is that dentists will often task a front desk with saying, right, you know, here's a list of 300 people that haven't been to see us for the last 2 years. Can you just phone them all up? And the front desk goes, I'm pretty busy, actually. Yeah, it's only 300 calls, you know, you just get on with it. You know, it doesn't always work when you're trying to make calls in volume via your front desk resource, because those people are busy already. You know, they're answering the phone, booking appointments, meeting and greeting patients, they're taking payment for patients leaving, the dentist might be asking them for a file or whatever it might be. And then for someone to say, right, here's 300 calls to make, you know, crack on with it, it just doesn't happen. And also,
Jonathan, I'd have thought as well, is there something around skill set as well? Because if you're taking an inbound call from a patient who just wants to book in, that's very different than what is kind of teaching towards a sales call. And it's not hard sales at all, but there's a sales call of sorts to trying to reactivate a patient. And the team members in the practice might feel uncomfortable making those calls because they don't have the skills. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to position it.
And they don't have the resilience when people say no.
No.
Absolutely right. That you've taken the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to say, you know, front desk team members, they don't like picking up the phone and making that outbound call. It's easy if someone's phoning in because they want to talk to you. But making that outbound approach, you're right, Andy, it is seen as selling. It's seen as cold calling. They see it as being intrusive. They think people are going to be nasty to them and all those kind of negative things. So they shy away from doing it. And, of course, you know, any in-house campaign fails to pick up any momentum. It might start with good intentions, but then it just gets pushed off to the side in favour of something else. So we come in and we pick up that kind of work. And we do it in volume, simple as that. So we will take a list of patients from a practice. This is on our patient reactivation service. Patients that haven't been in for anywhere between, say, 12 months and 5 years. And, you know, we'll get them on the phone. We'll have a conversation with them. We'll re-engage with them. We'll reacquaint them with the practice. We'll remind them that they're still registered. And where we can, we'll generate an appointment during that live call for them to come back in for a routine dental examination.
I was going to say, I remember when we first met you, the success stats are quite staggering.
Yeah.
So do you want to sort of share those with us? And
The amount of money that sits within a dental practice's database that's been left on a table is phenomenal. I think often practices think, well, those people haven't been in for 3 years, so complete waste of time. Let's just make them inactive. In my opinion, coming from a bit of a sales background, it's not a no until they've said no, basically. So there's still an opportunity. But when we engage with lost patients, we'll convert anywhere between kind of 18 and 28% into an appointment. And you touched on it before, there's no hard sell whatsoever. It's very much the patient's choice. And, you know, you just wouldn't believe the people who kind of go, crikey, is it really that long since I've been in it? It seems like 12 months ago. And it's like, no, it was actually, 4 years. So you get a bit of that. You get people going, well, it got to 18 months and then I got scared because I thought I might get told off if I phone the practice that I haven't been. And, you know, then there's other people who just take the view that if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of thing.
Mm.
But
in our business, in our Franktown Associates business, we value dental practices. And one of the things that people are quite good at being able to tell us is how many new patients they get in any given month.
But no one can tell you how many they've lost.
Yeah, I was going to say, my best guess is, and you'd probably be able to answer it, is do practices know how many they've lost? And when you go through the exercise with them, are they quite surprised at how many patients haven't been to the practice for 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
Yeah. No one's measuring how many are lost.
It's a hole in the bucket, isn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, the only metric the kind of looking at is how many new patients have we got coming through the door. Because that tells them if the social media advertising is working and all that kind of stuff. Mm. But and they'll do the patient recall thing, which is generated through the practice management software. And to be fair, they'll get quite a good response. You know, they might get 85%, something like that. It's not bad. But the 15% that drops off over time, you know, that can be thousands of patients that they're losing and they're having to chuck money in at the other end to replace them with new patients.
Yeah. I remember you saying that when we sort of looked at it and said, you know, if you've got a, if you manage to get 100 patients, which, you know, isn't back in the chair, then, you know, if you're, if it's £50 or £100 per exam, that's a real revenue stream, and out of that will probably be other bits of work.
Yeah,
so it's
absolutely.
It's almost, we always just think it's a no-brainer, really, because you're being paid to deliver results anyway. And I think the other thing that I quite liked as well was you said that not only do you get to maybe reappoint, but you also get almost you get patient feedback on how the practice is running, don't you, as to various bits. And I think that's a really important one for people listening to. It's not just about booking appointments.
We're getting a lot of feedback from patients. So the big one at the moment that we're hearing more and more is people saying they can't afford to come to the dentist. So 18 months ago, they would say something like, you're too expensive. So what they were saying there was, it's not that I can't afford it, I'm just not prepared to pay it. But now they are actually saying, I can't afford it. You know, we can feed that back to practices. It's all useful stuff. We hear all sorts of stories about how people have been treated and, you know, why they've left. So again, we can feed that back because it helps practices increase their levels of customer care. You know, there's a lot more that we can bring to the party over and above just generating that appointment.
And as a general rule, are practices good at having structured communication plans with their patients? Yeah, they have kind of those that come in get treated well. And it's, I think it's like lots of businesses. Once you're in their ecosystem and your experience of service, the processes work quite well. You know, booking appointments, seeing the dentist, follow up for that treatment, paying for the treatment, that's all good. But it's to people on the fringes that kind of miss out.
Get lost.
Yeah, a practice is good at harnessing those. I guess, putting it bluntly, is do they work their database to the extent that they should?
No, I don't think they do. I think they do a lot of lazy marketing with it. So, for example, you know, they'll send an SMS, they'll send an email, they might send a postcard mailing, something like that. And, you know, you just don't get the response that you're looking for. If you get a 2% response on that, even though they're existing patients, you're kind of doing all right, I think. But I think everyone thinks, you know, right, we've sent the email, let's just sit back and wait for the phone to ring off the hook, but it just doesn't happen. So I think, you know, where we come in and where we really add value is we just come in and hit the phones. It's literally rolling your sleeves up and making some phone calls, lighting some fires, and see which ones flare up.
What's your sort of best story, best result that you could, quite often, obviously, when you're trying to convince people to buy into the service, is there sort of like a couple of stories, and which ones are your best ones?
Yeah, so I think the best one that we've had over the last 12 months is a practice in Berkshire. So we were brought in because they put on a new surgery. So they're going through a bit of a growth spurt and they needed to fill that surgery quite quickly. They had quite a lot of lost patients, in excess of 2,000. We just hit the phones over a 12-month period and we were generating, let's say, 100 appointments a month for them, something like that, running alongside all their new business activities. So it really, really started to make sense for them. So over the 12-month period, I know we generated over 1,000 appointments for them. And we were lucky enough to get some financials back from them on that. The average spend of a patient from that initial appointment was just shy of 180 quid. So, wow. You know, 12 months just picking up the phone, we've dropped 180 grand worth of business on just from that initial appointment. That doesn't take into account the fact that they're going to get seen in 6 months. Or, you know, there's going to be a few implant cases in there and Invisalign and so on. You know, it works. There's no question.
Yeah, and your cost isn't anywhere near that. So no, it's a real revenue generator, isn't it?
That's it. And you know, we just get paid for each appointment that that actually attends the practice as a result of our activity.
Yeah,
it's a no-brainer, isn't it? Really. Yeah, it's a no-brainer. You know, it's like we say about commission, paying them to pay finance commission on 0% interest. You only pay it when you actually get a deal, and yours is the same thing. You only pay it when someone comes in. Why wouldn't you outsource this to your company to boost your numbers, to get people back in the surgery?
You also glossed over something, Jonathan, when you said about kind of the future revenue. And that kind of touches on lifetime value of the patient. And if these patients were previously visiting a practice and weren't, by reactivating them, it's not just the money in that year. Because, you know, like I say, I think the lifetime value of a patient in a private practice is going to be multiple thousands of pounds.
Yeah,
so long as they continue to communicate with them and they continue to become active.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And unfortunately, we just don't get that feedback from practices because obviously once the patient's been in for that initial appointment, it's kind of over to them and, you know, we're not tracking it for them. I'd love to know what the kind of ongoing income is.
Well, if you think £1,000, if you think, you know, it'd be quite reasonable when you have 10 years, £1,000 over 10 years, when you think that's £100 appointment a year, that's £1 million.
Significant. Yeah. Jonathan, aside from your service, do you have any kind of nuggets or tips on how to get team members on the phone? Obviously, you're the experts in this, but as Chris was saying, I think particularly amongst younger people, there is a resistance to use the phone. Do you have any kind of insights as to why that would be and how they can get people on the phone more? Because there's no doubt it does produce results.
It does, there's no question. So for young people, you know, as we kind of said, you know, their life revolves around a smartphone. And they can hide behind a screen, you know. They don't like speaking on the phone, really. They're quite reluctant to, A, answer a phone if someone phones them, but to actually make a phone call, crikey, you know. So I genuinely don't know the answer. I mean, the people we employ, they're all more mature. So they're used to it, you know. They just kind of crack on with it. It's no big deal to them at all. I genuinely don't know the answer, Andy. It's a difficult question there.
Well, for me, I'm kind of already 20 years ahead, and I'm like, okay, so if you've got slightly more mature people who are comfortable with that now, but we have a generation already who aren't comfortable, if we roll out 20 years from now, where will the people who have the art of conversation, the confidence to be on the phone, those people are going to become really valuable?
They're a rarity, aren't they?
I mean, my worry at the moment is that AI could take it over. I'm But in certain situations, I think AI could take over telemarketing. I don't think it will for this. You've got to have the personal touch on this. But for youngsters, yeah, it's a tricky one. It genuinely is a tricky one to get them to pick up the phone and make that that kind of cold call.
It is weird, isn't it?
One of the things that probably does help is if the leads are better qualified, you know, through the online inquiry generation service that you might be using. We've been working on some other projects, not just the patient reactivation stuff. We've been running some projects, running social media advertising, and then handling the inbound inquiry ourselves, and really just qualifying that lead out and then presenting a practice with a fully qualified consultation. So they don't have to bother with it. You know, they don't have to deal with 10 inquiries. They're just dealing with one consultation. But we incorporated AI into that to handle the qualification of the lead. And it was amazing. Because it would take it through to the stage where it's asking all the right questions. It's asking what your situation is. It's asking what your budget is, what your timescales are. Is there an event coming up? Blah, blah, blah. It can then talk about how you intend to fund your dental treatment. It can ask, and it keeps asking you if you want to book a consultation. And eventually it gets them to a yes, I want to book. Because they've been fully qualified. So when you pick up the phone, it's quite an easy call to make.
And I think using AI, I think a lot of it comes down to prompts and asking the right questions. If you're able to ask questions that take you closer to the place that you need them to be before a human steps in, I think it's really valuable. But I think a lot of people haven't quite got to the stage where they understand what to ask of AI
to make sure they get
the right answer, which is then usable information.
It's like rubbish in, rubbish out, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly it. But you know, the AI, I mean, we didn't develop it. We worked with a kind of techie guy. You know, we had a guy come online at 12 o'clock in the evening, something like that, 12 o'clock at night, saying, you know, I'm interested in Invisalign. And, you know, the AI takes over. It's not your bog standard chatbot that you see on any other website. Yeah. And, you know, it's asking all the right questions. And he ended up saying it's actually for my daughter. So the AI instantly goes, how old is your daughter? And has she actually looked online at, you know, what treatments are available to her? So instantly jumped on that, totally unprompted, handled all the qualification of the lead. We came in the morning, the lead's there on the CRM, phone him up, book him in. Easy.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me with the recent demise of Smile Direct Club. It wouldn't surprise me if there's lots of dental practices that are going to be seeing more patients coming and wanting
mid-treatment.
You know. Yeah, but also that renewed interest and value of a, you know, an oral health professional. You know, like I say, I think lots of things are good until they go wrong. And this has been a classic example of something that's gone wrong. And it actually, in the long term, it does feed back into the dentist's hands, which are these are people that spend a minimum of 5 years at dental school learning their thing, plus CPD. And that's what's needed if you're going to get your teeth looked after to see you through for the rest of your life.
Not something in the post.
Yeah. Jonathan, you've had a very wide and varied career. You've done lots of different things. If you could distill that down to one single learning through your entrepreneurial journey, what would you say the key thing is?
I would say, I think there's a couple of things, if you don't mind. I think the first one is
all right, you can have a couple.
Always be good to deal with.
That's nice.
Be nice. Yeah.
So, you know, treat customers, suppliers, staff, stakeholders, you know, just treat them all with the utmost respect. Always be polite to them, all that kind of stuff. So that's the first one, always be good to deal with. And I think the second one is a piece of advice that someone gave me 20 years ago. He said he'd made a lot of money, and he said, always make sure there's enough in it for the other man.
True.
And what he meant by that, as you can imagine, was if you're in a negotiation, just get it to a win-win. You don't have to absolutely run someone into the ground. Because everyone,
otherwise they don't want to do it, do they?
So those are the two things I've really, really taken on board.
Fabulous.
It's lovely to be nice, one, isn't it? We quite often say to people, you know, for goodness sake, you know, you can be nice, still get what you want, but be nice.
Yeah.
It costs you nothing. It costs you nothing, and it's good for the other person, and you don't do it for this reason, but you generally get a better outcome as well, notwithstanding the fact that it makes you feel good because you've looked after the person, but you'll generally get a better outcome, whatever it is. Jonathan, you've done a number of things over the years for your son's school. I've got a list here. It's quite remarkable, really. So last year, the National Three Peaks, 3 times in 5 days.
Wow.
The year before that, kayaked 120.
Well, all three?
Yeah.
In 5 days.
Three times, 5 days.
Yeah, that's impressive.
The year before, 127 miles kayaking from Liverpool to Leeds along the canal. Ooh. And then back in 2021, the Yorkshire Three Peaks, again, 3 times in 3 days. So, Jonathan, tell us why such extreme ventures? And have you got anything in the pipeline for 2024?
He doesn't have much holiday, so he has to cram it in.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my son, who's 17, he got a diagnosis of autism when he was about 3 or 4, I think, something like that. And we managed to get him in at a fantastic school, which is just for autistic kids. So I thought, you know, we were kind of blessed to get him in there. So I kind of thought you've got to give something back to that. So, you know, it's easy to do a bit of a sponsored walk and all that kind of stuff. But I thought you've got to go
a bit more.
Do something a little bit challenging, haven't you? So the first year, or the first 2 years, I did the Yorkshire Three Peaks thing. Walking them 3 times in 3 days. So you kind of go round once, have a kip, go around again, have a kip, go around again. Quite tiring.
Wow. I can imagine.
And then, you know, came up with the kayaking thing.
That's a lot, 127 miles, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, it was one of the best things I've ever done. It was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Did you just do it on your own?
No.
Did you do it on your own?
I had a 2-man kayak. I was in with a friend of mine, Dominic, who is one of the guys that I worked with back in the old catering days. So, you know, spending 5 days in a canoe, a kayak with one of your best mates is great fun. So, you know, we did it over 5 days, started in Liverpool. And we'd never kayaked before. You know, we couldn't even steer the blooming thing.
Seriously.
Wow. We literally bought the kayak, chucked it on the car, drove to Liverpool, chucked it in and went.
And then did 127 miles.
Yeah, so the first day we did 40 miles, I think. We kayaked from Liverpool to Wigan or somewhere like that.
My goodness.
And I bet your shoulders ached.
Checked into a hotel. And then, you know, the next day was like 30 miles. But by that time, we were kind of back into Yorkshire and, you know, we could, someone would come and pick us up and we'd have our own beds for the night. But yeah, it's great fun. Great fun.
And then last year, what's coming? So
last year, National Three Peaks, 3 times in 5 days. So I just came up with it I was probably a bit drunk, to be fair. I thought, you know, how hard can it be? Normally when you do the National Three Peaks, you kind of do it as a circuit. You move from one peak to the next but what I did was I kind of we went up to Scotland and did Ben Nevis 3 times. So I did it twice in one day and then once the following morning. Drove down to the Lake District and did Scafell Pike 2 in 1 day, once the following morning, and then down to Wales to Snowdon, up and down there 2 in 1 day and once the following morning. It was
great. Oh, my word. Were you wrecked at the end of it?
Yeah, absolutely wrecked. But you know, 57, Chris, yeah. So.
I'm so impressed. How much money did you raise?
Not very much, to be honest. the input far outweighed the output, believe me.
Oh, well.
But, you know, just doing those things, they're great. Just getting out and having that thinking time, to be fair. I know you're kind of doing a bit of a challenge, but it's great to get out there, out of the office, away from work, because you still think about work, but there's no pressure to think about work, if that makes sense. And that's when you come up with your best ideas, isn't it?
Oh, of course you do. Of course you do. And it's that thing, isn't it? Just because I'm not doing something doesn't mean I'm not busy.
Yeah.
You can be thinking, and in your head you can be working stuff out. But you might be walking, kayaking, whatever you're doing. But
processing.
Like you say, you can. Yeah, the stuff's going on inside the head, isn't it?
The challenge for next.
So what have you got coming up for this year?
Next summer's challenge, I might jump back in the kayak again, and I'm thinking, could we find a route, you know, from Leeds down to London or something like that along the canal network? That'd be quite interesting.
What's the Grand Union? Where does that go?
I've got no idea.
No. So it must be. Because there must be, mustn't it? Because obviously that's how they transport all the goods around. Yeah.
And, you know, I've always got this attitude of how hard can it be? So once I've decided I'm going to do it, it will definitely happen, I can tell you.
That's a good start point.
Paragliding off Ben Nevis.
That's a good start point. I think naivety is a very underrated skill. I think having a bit of naivety means you get things done.
Do you know what? You're absolutely right, Andy. I agree with that.
Jonathan, it's been wonderful. We are coming towards the end, but we can't let you go just yet.
Dun, 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 dun.
We have two questions for you. And the first question that we'd like to finish up with is, if you could be the fly on a wall in a situation, when would that be and who would be there?
I'm going to be intrigued on this one. Because it's like non-dental man.
Yeah.
You know, no dentist connection at all. So I'm interested to see.
Okay. I mean, I have been primed for this question, so I have got something. So I've got two answers just to keep annoying you. The first answer is quite dark and actually quite miserable, actually. But 3 months ago, I went to Poland and I went to Auschwitz. And I don't know if you've ever been, but it absolutely blew my mind. It's been a bit life-changing, actually. And even having listened to the stories and, you know, seen the place itself, I don't think I've got a full understanding of the actual horror that that went on there. So in a kind of weird way, I think being a fly on the wall in that place at that time when those things were going on, just to really understand the scale of it, the brutality, the fear.
The true horror of it.
Because we just can't understand it. So that's the first one.
I think it does serve as a great reminder, though, as hard as it is a place to visit. I think to see it and to think about what humans are capable of, it's a great reminder.
Inhumanity to man, you know, it's just phenomenal.
It's scary about the number of people who are denying it.
Oh, yeah.
There's a whole big thing in the States about it, wasn't there?
But anyway,
enough of that.
The second one, on a lighter note, so my all-time favourite TV programme is The Persuaders, Roger Moore and Tony Curtis. I would want to be a fly on the wall when they're filming some of those episodes. I thought they were absolutely brilliant. They're so daft and, you know, Roger Moore's kind of pomposity and Tony Curtis is just, you know, cheeky, chappy American.
Yeah.
I thought they were brilliant. I bet they had such a laugh making those programmes. So,
They were good, those ones, weren't they?
A different era.
It was the one with the dead bloke, wasn't it? I can't remember what that was.
Oh, I can't remember.
I used to quite enjoy that one. He was a ghost or something.
Randall and if you were given, Jonathan, if you were given...
Oh, there we go, Randall and Hopkirk. Good man. Randall and Hopkirk deceased, wasn't it?
Correct.
Good man.
And if you were given the opportunity to meet somebody, who would you like to sit down and have a nice glass of beer, wine, coffee, whatever your tip is?
It's someone from the past, it would be Steve McQueen.
I was going to say, for people watching this on YouTube, you'll see Steve over Jonathan's shoulder. If you're listening to this as a podcast, he's got a lovely piece of art of Steve McQueen from The Great Escape behind him.
From his brother, who's available for commissions.
So, I just thought the guy was great. You know, he's charismatic. Mm. He did lots of kind of action stuff. You know, he's into racing, driving, and motorcycling and stuff like that. Coincidentally, I passed my motorbike test about 18 months ago. So I'm now officially a motorcyclist.
Very good.
He's trying to find a fence to jump it over.
You know, watching all those films with Steve McQueen when I was growing up, The Magnificent Seven, Bullet, Thomas Crown Affair, all those. They were just amazing films, weren't they?
So it used to be Sundays, wasn't it? Sunday afternoon. What's it down and watch a film, I think.
Yeah. So, yeah, Steve McQueen, that's who I'd like to have a beer with, no question.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Jonathan, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So many elements to what you do. Hospitality, the restaurant, the pubs, moving into marketing, and just the tips for me, the biggie is like, get on the phone. You know, don't be shy. Use the phone. It's a tool that probably has kind of slipped into the background in terms of a communication tool, but it gives us that one-to-one. So it's been a wonderful conversation. Really appreciate your time today.
Stepping out. Your comfort. Yeah. I think the fact you bought a kayak and then did 127 miles put that really on the cards, doesn't it? It follows.
Yeah. You just
give it a go.
You know, you're absolutely right, Andy. You've hit the nail on the head. That naivety really helped us through on that one.
Yeah. Brilliant. Lovely. Appreciate your time today, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. Take care, man.
All right. Keep well. Cheers.
See you soon. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.